Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 122, Interview with Michelle Lang.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a Zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean. And
this is Brent.
And today we are joined by Michelle Lang. And I swear, I can't even swear that. I was going to say I swear this is the last World Fantasy Convention interview, but there's still blanks.
There's still one more.
But the thing is, Michelle's, her novel's just coming out in mass market, so totally applicable. Good timing. And we're holding on to Blake's because his second book's coming out soon. So once that is ready to come out, we'll release Blake's. That's the idea, right, Brent?
That's correct. Sure.
Okay. Once again, this episode is brought to you by Clark's World Magazine. ClarksWorldMagazine.com is their website. And I've been saying a lot of nice things about them. And I hope everyone knows I mean them. I'm not just saying that because they're sponsoring the show for a few episodes. Clark's World's great, so please go check them out. Read their fiction. Support them in any way you can. ClarksWorldMagazine.com. So we do have some things to talk about before we get to the interview. And two big things. We are going to announce all the details on our big Summer of Sci-Fi trivia. Okay, this is a big contest that we hinted at last time. Very excited about this. Two other podcasts are going to participate in this with us. I Should Be Writing and SF Signal. Of course, SF Signal is much more than a podcast. If you haven't been to sfsignal.com, what are you doing? Get over there and check it out. So here's what we're doing. The three of us are teaming up to bring you the Sci-Fi Trivia Giveaway this summer. This will be sponsored by Pyre Books, and we have 12 titles to give away to 6 lucky winners. And they will be selected at random from eligible entries. So let's tease you with the prizes here. So first place is going to get 4 big ones. Sasha, Petrador, and Tricado, the first 3 books in A Trial of Blood and Steel by Joel Shepard. Now, I will confess I have not read these books yet, but I have heard nothing but good things about them. My brother-in-law is a huge fantasy fan. He probably reads 30 to 40 fantasy novels a year. And he just chewed through these things. He couldn't. In fact, he just went out of country and he was dying because I didn't get book 4 yet before he left. So he couldn't read it. Go buy it yourself. Anyway, and then the 4th book in that pack will be the Bunchline Special by Mike Resnick, which is a fun Weird West steampunk novel that I did read and I enjoyed. Second place will be The Strange Affairs of Spring Hill Jack by Mark Hodder, Shadow Sun by John Sprunk, who's been on the show, and The Falling Machine by Andrew Mayer. Third place will be Diving into the Wreck and City of Ruins by Kristen Catherine Rush. Those are 2 books that go together, and we are interviewing her next week, so she's going to be on the show very soon. And then we have 3 runner-ups, and one of those will get The Dervish House, Hugo nominated by Ian McDonald. One will get Ghosts of Manhattan by George Mann, and one will get The Greyfriar by Clay and Susan Griffith, who have also both been on the show. So there you have it. We'll put all these on the website, of course, so you can check them out. But first, there are some rules. Here's how you can enter.
Well, there are some rules. And boy, those runner-up titles, I don't feel like those are runner-ups at all, honestly. Those are some excellent titles as runner-ups. In fact, The Dervish House was like my mistake, or was it nominated for a Hugo?
Yeah, best novel.
Ah. So, yeah, hardly what I would call a runner-up.
Well, it's a runner-up because you only get one book.
You only get one, but you're getting a dynamite book.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, they are awesome.
All these books are great. There's not a you know, I was working with Jill to figure out what we could give away, and I was so excited by the list that we came up with.
Oh, it pains me to get to the rules, but there must be some, right? So I'd rather focus on the titles. But we do have some rules, folks, and due to copyright restrictions, this contest is open only to residents of North America. In the month of June, all three participating podcasts will feature one sci-fi trivia question. To enter the contest, simply submit your answers to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing at gmail.com by midnight on Friday, July 22nd.
Lots of time.
Plenty of time. Please include your name, address, and phone number with your entry. The phone number will only be used in case of technical difficulties with your email address. Spam and the like, you know, that spam stuff. Winners will be selected by blind drawing and notified by email before subsequent announcements through the participating podcasts. Everything about the contest will be posted in a feature story on our site, and only one entry per person.
And the idea behind the trivia questions are they will be simple. So if you don't know the answer, you should be able to find it very quickly in a Google search. So it's not going to be some obscure, you know, in the 1957 novel Attack of the Martian Women. What is the lieutenant commander's name who crashes the spaceship into Jupiter? Yeah, it's not going to. You like that question? I did that. Can you tell? I just pulled that out of my. So they will be a larger genre topics that you'll be able to find pretty quickly just by a Google search if you don't know the answer. I didn't want anyone to get, and you know, wait. I don't want anyone to spend hours and hours trying to find an answer to a question.
This isn't Stump the Chump. It's an accessible contest.
That's right. Yeah. So all three questions will be given on these three podcasts in the month of June. And they'll be listed, too, on our homepage. So you don't, you know, because we all put out a fair number of shows. So that way you don't have to listen to like 15 shows just to get one or two questions. So they'll be listed in the show notes, not the questions themselves. But when Sci-Fi Signal posts the trivia question in their podcast, it'll be in the show notes. This episode contains the trivia question. Same with I Should Be Writing. This episode contains the trivia question. And then we'll have those posted on our site, too. So trying to make it as easy as possible, but still have some fun. And we did this, as we know, we talked about this a couple of years ago, and it was a lot of fun. I was very pleased with how many people participated. So check it out. Make sure you do it. And listen up, because our question will be, I don't think in the next episode, but probably the one after that, just to give you a heads up.
We just pays to listen, doesn't it?
It does. We just have to figure out what the question is first. Brent's on it.
I'm on it. You like the three I sent you, huh?
Actually, no. I didn't like those.
Oh, man. Would it help if in the first one I had put former co-host who was more entertaining and attractive, though Moses being called pretty may have taken exception?
Yeah, your sample question about Sam?
Yeah.
No, actually, that one was kind of fun.
But yeah. I thought a little trivia about the podcast itself might be fun. That's where I was going with that.
Well, maybe we'll talk about this. We'll get off air and we'll talk about this.
Cut.
Which former host originally won the first book contest with I Should Be Right?
Hey, there you go. Which former host? Wait a second. I didn't hear that adjective.
As you said, it pays to listen.
Yes, it does.
Okay, now, so we have three contests going on right now. Don't forget, we have the Buffalito Destiny contest and the Michelle. Wait a minute. Did we announce the Michelle Lang contest?
We didn't announce the Michelle Lang contest. I thought we were doing this in reverse order.
Oh, I forgot. Go ahead. Tell us about the Michelle Lang contest.
Here's the deal on the Michelle Lang. This is now officially the Michelle Lang book giveaway. Michelle. Having listened to the podcast and watching Twitter, I know she follows a few of us on Twitter, was so enthralled with us giving away so many books that she's graciously agreed to give away Lady Lazarus, which is the book that was just released in mass market paperback. And if you're not familiar with Lady Lazarus, it's an interesting mashup of witches, vampires, angels, and demons all on the eve of World War II. It starts out in in Hungary and Budapest, and the protagonist, Magda Lazarus, is the last in the line of a powerful Jewish Lazarus witches, and her sister, who's a seer, has visions of the pending war, and Magda has to set out to hopefully stop the war. And then along the way, there's the whole tale of Lady Lazarus, where she basically can resurrect herself from the dead. And so it's an interesting, really interesting book list. Gave it a starred review. As a very interesting urban historical fantasy. So, and very lyrical in its prose. It's probably one of the better books from a prose standpoint that I read all of last year. A few words about the book. We know we're going to be giving away a book. I'm going to see if I can twist Michelle's arm and see if she might be able to autograph it as well. So I believe it's coming straight from Michelle, and the lucky winner will hopefully receive an autographed copy. The rules that we're going to use for the book giveaway are the same rules as the Buffalito Destiny giveaway. And those rules were an entry into the contest. You just need to tweet something about a summer of book giveaways at symbol AISFP podcast on Twitter. Please include a URL to our site if you can, and you're entered. Entries must be received again by June 22nd at midnight. And if you don't have Twitter, don't worry about it. Just email 10 friends and include us in the carbon copy line, the CC line. That'd be great.
And if your book isn't autographed, send your hate mail to Brent at adventuresinscifipublishing.com. That's not a real email, so you won't get it, Brent. Don't worry about it.
I won't get it. You can send it to former co-host of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Brent Bowen.
Okay, I hope no one's confused now. So three book giveaways going on right now. Two of them are due June 22nd, and then the trivia contest July 22nd. That's to give you plenty of time to get all three questions and get all three answers in. Okay, that's it on the contest, right?
I think so, until we have another author ready to give away more books. Would we object?
No, if you're an author and like to give away books to our listeners, yeah. okay, so what we're also going to be doing this summer, we got all these book drives going on, all this extra promotion. We're going to be doing extra shows in June and July, and probably into August as well. So lots of extra content is coming, and part of this is because we're going to do a fun drive. I have never asked, well, that's not true. I have asked a couple of times for donations, but it's been years since I have. I didn't even have the PayPal button on the site for a year and a half. For this month, the rest of June and into July, we are going to be asking for your support, and we'll be offering up some books in appreciation of that as well. If you've been listening for a long time, in particular, we'd ask you to please consider supporting us. We hope to be going to World Con and World Fantasy this year. But, you know, we need some help doing that. The travel and the hotel, it's all very expensive. We don't expect to get it all paid for, but we could use some help. By attending these conventions, you know, we're able to meet great writers and industry professionals. And we deepen the show's tie with the writing and reading community, I feel being there and really meeting people really helps solidify the show, and it makes people want to come on the show and want to support the show and want to send information to us when things happen and want to feature things on our show. So it increases our ability to bring things to our audience. So audience growth comes from the increased opportunities, which allows us to do more. You know, it's kind of a snowball effect. So at this point, you know, I've pretty much paid for everything in the podcast myself since I started it, but I can't really do that anymore because I haven't had a full-time job in 3 years. Not from lack of trying, people, okay? Don't judge me. Anyway, obviously, if you're like me and you don't have full-time employment and you can't support us financially, we totally understand that. But still, during these next 6 weeks when we're doing this push, if you can, you know, blog about us or write a review in iTunes or maybe even do a short little interview with us for your blog. You know, we can be available for that. You know, anything you can do just to help support the show, we really appreciate it. So that's going to be kind of our push for the next 6 weeks. I know Mer Lafferty just did this a couple months ago, which is funny because I've been thinking about doing this for like, you know, 6 or 8 months. I'm like, darn it, she beat me to it. totally going to look like a copycat now.
There are worse people to copy than Murr, though.
Yeah, that's true. But here's what we're going to do. For anyone who donates $20, we're going to send you a book. If you donate $40, we're going to send you two books. And if you donate $60 or more, we're going to send you three books. And that's for North America only, I am afraid. So $20, one book, $40, two books, $60, three books. Obviously, you know, donating to support the show, you're not doing it to get the books. The books are just a way for us to say thank you, that we appreciate it. But, you know, $5 helps. You know, if 100 listeners give us $5, then that makes the traveling to the conventions a lot easier for us to do. And I blew out a channel on my preamp, so I am one blown channel away from not being able to record. So there's some equipment replacement. All my equipment is original from 2006, so some of it is starting to die on me. So that's about it. Brent, did I leave anything out on that?
I think you covered it all, sir. It does help. You know, when we sit down to interview an author, one of my standard things is, and it's the little stuff too, you know, so even if it's that $5, every time I sit down in person with an author, you know, I've got a bottle of water waiting for them. And, you know, anybody that's picked up a bottle of water in a hotel knows that that's easily $2 a pop or a cup of coffee, just so they can bring us the best show that they possibly can. So I know that even if it doesn't go to getting us to the convention sometimes, there are a lot of incidentals that get picked up along the way as well. And hopefully, you know, through the nature of making that personal relationship and that personal contact with the authors too, we can continue to bring things like the contest. You know, Michelle, a lot of that, I think, you know, the Michelle Lang piece was through the connection she and I made at World Fantasy and the great conversation we had, and the fact that when it came time to get the interview ready, she's like, hey, you know what? I want to give away a book too.
Yeah, the donations will primarily go to the travel expenses for the conventions and for equipment replacements. So it's all going straight back into the show. We're not going to go out to Ruth's Chris.
No.
Unless Brent's paying and taking us. So thank you, everyone, who's been listening for all these years, and really appreciate your support. I mean, we're up to almost 60, you know, reviews in iTunes now, which is amazing. And if you can support us this way within the next 6 weeks, we're going to be reminding you every episode and really asking for that, because we haven't, but we really could use it and just appreciate it. Homepage, there's a PayPal link right there on the right side of the homepage. Can't miss it. Thank you. Thank you very much for considering it. All right, Brent, we've been gabbing a long time. I think we should sign off, get to our interview.
Sounds good to me.
One of my favorite magazines over the last few years has been Clark's World Magazine. And I'm not just saying that because they published one of the interviews I did a few years ago, but they did, which makes them even more awesome. I'm saying this because they have some of the best short fiction and nonfiction around, and their 2010 Hugo Award proves it. So, if you're looking for great short stories, articles, interviews, and a whole lot more, come to clarksworldmagazine.com. You can read their stories online, subscribe to their podcast, or you can order the ebook editions of their issues. They also have an annual anthology, which is great. It's awesome. It's a perfect collector's edition to put up on your shelf. And so you can enjoy these stories again and again right there where you want them. And don't miss out on the opportunity to become a Clark's World citizen. So support the magazine that supports us, will ya? ClarksWorldMagazine.com.
Hello, my name is Joshua Liu, and I'm the sometimes oft-times film reviewer for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Now, some background on myself, since many of you out there may be hearing about me right now for the very first time. I've been an avid film viewer for over 20 years. I watch way too many films that it's pretty much unhealthy, and I try to and see every film released each and every year. Now, naturally, that's an impossible task, but I love collecting knowledge and scenes like a book lover collects words, and I have such an immense passion for film that I hope translates into my reviews. So when Sean asked me if I wanted to review a lo-fi, sci-fi, independent film for the podcast, I said I would love to, a click on the checklist in the proverbial checkbox in my head. So here's a review of the film, Reversion. Now, this is a 2008 independent science fiction film, and was screened at the 2008 Sundance Film Festival, and has been seeking distribution ever since. It's the sophomore effort from director Mia Tratzinger after 2003's Bunny, and stars J. Jason Olive and Leslie Silva, and is the story of Eva, a group of genetic mutants who live in a world where their past, present, and future all unfold at the same time. Because of their genetic mutation, these group of individuals are devoid of any morality and consequence. Now, somewhere down the road, Eva learns that she's going to kill the man she loves, and she races to stop what has already been written in her destiny. Now, it's hard to review independent films like these because you know they're made because the filmmakers needed to make a film to see their vision come to life regardless of budget and location constraints. Even harder if the film isn't good because you don't want to deride a film that was so clearly made out of love, out of a burning need. Now, if it was a big budget Hollywood affair, it's easy to rant over a poor film because they had the budget and backing to make it a good film, but sadly didn't. But a film is still a film regardless of budget or passion, so you have to take into account the merits of the film as entertainment and art, and that's how I'll be reviewing this film. Here in Reversion, the plot is a bit hard to digest, and the film starts incredibly slow, especially when you take into account that its runtime is only 71 minutes long. And you don't really find out what the plot is until three-fourths through the film. So in the beginning, all you're watching is a group of people walk around, talk, and be incredibly cryptic. Maybe not cryptic to them, but increasingly so to the viewer, since we aren't privy to what's going on. Now, when I was sitting down to thinking about what synopsis to give for this film, I had to give away some plot points, because if I only talked about what happens in the three-fourths of the beginning of the film without giving away the overall plot, it would just be, here's a film with two people walking around, and I can't even tell you what happened. So, you know, I hope you forgive me for giving some plot points away. Okay, so this film is all about time dilation, and there are some nice dilation effects, as the characters skip in and out of time, since they live life and time in all moments rather than linearly, as they also live in the same moments over and over again, an existence evidently called new life. It can be very jarring in the beginning, especially when you don't know what's going on. But eventually, it starts to feel like a necessary, if perhaps too often used, stylistic choice from the director, Mia Tratzinger. It just would have been more of a powerful framing device to the plot if it was used more sparingly. Also, the film consists of so many time jumps back and forward through the character's life that the viewer is left to feel very distant towards the main characters. Because honestly, it just feels like they're just going through the motions into an inevitable finale, like a marriage almost that has lost its love. The film plot is just also increasingly bizarre. You have a group of characters who are always being hunted because they're mutants, and you know, even though they look the same as we all do, and yet they steal, mug, and walk around in broad daylight like nothing can touch them, and nothing really does. People in this world are literally minutes away from getting mugged, since it happens almost every 5 minutes, and yet people walk about their day like nothing is wrong. I mean, I know that if it was me, I wouldn't carry too many valuables outside if I knew I was waiting to get mugged. And yet, characters always do so and are shocked when they are mugged, and it makes little sense. Also, no one appears to ever lock their car doors. So yeah, cars keep getting stolen. It's like a live version of the video game Grand Theft Auto. Everything in the plot feels a bit too haphazard, a bit too lackadaisical, that it really takes the viewer out of the film, so much so that you can't ever care about what happens to any of the characters. And when you don't care about the characters, you don't care about the film. Now, some of the acting isn't particularly strong, although to be fair, they consist of mostly unknown or amateur actors. However, the acting from Leslie Silva, who plays Eva, is a real eye-opener. She just conveys such wonderful brooding and confused emotion that she draws you into her character, even if the plot doesn't. Now, as for the overall look of the film, it's actually really nicely shot, as Mia Tratzinger sets up scene after scene with increasing skill as the landscape becomes just as much a character as any of the other characters in the film. However, the editing, the constant edit points and cuts, they're noticeable, because they can be a bit disconnected at times, and a viewer should never be taken out of a film by noticing the editing of a film. And also, the dialogue feels improvised at times, and not always for the better, as characters awkwardly talk and try to relate with one another. So, basically, Reversion sees its theatrical premiere in New York on June 10th. I hate to give films like these bad reviews because we need more of them, as I mentioned in the beginning. We need more passion projects, more films from independent filmmakers who make films because they need to, out of love, rather than because of monetary hopes, outside the studio system. We need more films like this and more directors like Mia Tratzinger. However, Reversion feels more like a tempered misstep, a sometimes rich collection of images that don't necessarily fit into a cohesive and entertaining story. It's needlessly confusing and keeps his narrative so close to its vest that it's nearly indecipherable. Everything feels slightly out of sync, and perhaps that's what the filmmakers were going for, but in the end, it just adds more to the confusion of the viewer, and I sadly can't recommend this as a watch. Now, I want to again thank Sean for giving me the opportunity to review this film for the podcast, this film Reversion. Hopefully in the near future, I'll be back again with a more positive review. If you'd like to follow me, I host a film podcast called Cinema Cafe Podcast, where I review new movie releases, DVD reviews, and talk some film news. You can find the podcast at cinemacafepodcast.blogspot.com or on iTunes. Just search Cinema Cafe Podcast, three words. Thanks for listening, and happy movie watching.
I'm here at World Fantasy Convention with Michelle Lang, author of the recently released historical urban fantasy Lady Lazarus from Tor. Like her protagonist, Michelle is of Hungarian Jewish descent and plays an integral part in the book. Welcome, Michelle, to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And now, tell our readers a little bit about your book, Lady Lazarus.
Okay. It's a historical fantasy that's set right on the eve of World War II. The setting is a magical Budapest, and the protagonist is a woman by the name of Magda Lazarus, the Lady Lazarus of the title. And she is gifted with the power to summon souls. And her younger sister is gifted with the gift of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Though in those times, I don't know if it's a gift or a curse, right?
Certainly.
Right? So unfortunately, well, or fortunately, I guess, a few months before the war breaks out, these two girls in Budapest get this vision, a sure. terrible vision of what is going to occur. And so they resolve to do whatever they can to stop Hitler and his supernatural minions from waging total war.
Mm-hmm.
And so in desperation, Magda calls upon an avenging angel named Raziel. And together they join forces to fight Nazi wizards, SS werewolves, demonesses, the supernatural members of Hitler's war machine.
Okay. Well, in the supernatural, not only is in the factions of evil, now Magda encounters some folks that help her along the way, too, that
Absolutely.
with some supernatural abilities. You might kind of outline those folks for us a little
bit? Sure. Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, even before the story starts, she's really indebted to her employer,
mm-hmm.
who is a count who happens to be a vampire. His name is Count Gabor Báthory,
mm-hmm.
and he is an ancient member of the Fanged Nobility. He's a vampire born, and she, at the beginning of the book, is his loyal lieutenant, and she's kind of a wild, untamed creature, Magda Lazarus.
Yeah.
She's untrained, and the reason she is because she was very rebellious, and instead of submitting to her mother's teachings while her mother was alive, she instead wanted to run off and just throw herself into the cafe society of Budapest at the time.
Well, and that puts her into some precarious situations and calling souls as well throughout the course of the novel.
Right. Yes. I mean, the problem for Magda is she doesn't know. She's not schooled in the Lazarus Creed, so she really doesn't know what's permitted, what's not, what is a terrible transgression, and what is her birthright.
Mm-hmm.
So when she, in desperation, calls upon the angel Raziel, when she first does it, she's convinced she's done something that's just unforgivable. I mean, to summon the soul of an archangel, it seems like a very extreme thing.
Sure.
You know, so on the one hand, in her hopes, you know, this is a form of prayer, and she's not so much compelling him as asking him and begging him to save her.
Sure.
But on the other hand, she doesn't know because there's a compulsion involved in her abilities. So it's a real struggle for her to know the limits of her power, how to exercise that power judiciously, and when sometimes those questions of right and wrong just get swept away by war.
Yeah, and she was too wild of a spirit to kind of engage and understand those things before she was involved in the conflict.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the war forces her to confront these things for the first time.
Yeah. Now, in your acknowledgments and other interviews, you mention how difficult it was for you, yet how you still were very compelled to write this book. Explain to our listeners kind of your own personal conflict when writing Lady Lazarus.
Yeah, this book chased me down and made me write it. It's like the classic push-pull, because on the one hand, I had Magda Lazarus herself pulling at me. I've been hearing that voice in my head since probably 1995, some very long ago time. Sure. I've heard that voice in my head, and she's a very persistent voice, and she wouldn't go away until I agreed to write her story and write it the way that she knew it was supposed to be written. I mean, I've tried to put this book in other settings because this World War II setting for me is like the third rail. I don't want to touch it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like standing on holy ground. I don't.
Now, you had family members that were Holocaust
absolutely,
survivors,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Both of my parents were there. My mother is from Budapest. That is my family history.
Sure,
and
sure.
In some ways, this book is a magical version of my family's history. So I felt in some ways like it wasn't my story to tell. And so I felt very hesitant about going into, it's like crossing a wall of fire,
mm-hmm.
to go back to those people and what they had to do to survive. And I didn't know if I had the right to infuse that place, mm-hmm. with magic,
Yeah.
It's such an intense place. But in some ways, I think that that's what you need to survive something so extreme.
Do you think that lent itself into Magda's character? We just got done talking about the transgressions,
oh, yes.
and her concerned about crossing a line and not knowing where the line would be. Do you
yes,
think that,
also, yes, and
fears?
Also, absolutely, and also not knowing your heritage. You know, for me, being Jewish was something to hide.
Mm-hmm.
It was something to, my parents used to tell me growing up, because I was this blonde little thing. And they're like, you're blonde. That's good. No one, you can pass. And so it was something precious to hide.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not something that we learned. It was something that you would die for, but I didn't know why you would live for it.
Hmm.
So in some ways, Magda's ignorance is my ignorance.
Sure.
I also don't know Hebrew. I want to learn it.
Yeah.
And, if you get into the book, a lot of Magda's magic comes up out of the Jewish lore,
the
Jewish
mysticism. Yeah.
Yes, and so it's like her birthright, and yet she doesn't know how to tap into it and how to make judicious use of her gift because she never learned her birthright.
Yeah.
And I can see the parallel with me in that respect.
Now, did you get your family involved when you were writing the book or in any sort of the process where this is kind of a clandestine effort?
when you were at
home and it might be a holiday perhaps.
Well,
and they said, Michelle, what are you working on?
Well, it's hard because, it's very intense personal stuff, and this stuff does not get routinely discussed. I mean, I think it's something I took in like osmosis growing up, and my mother comes from this, Hungarian culture is infused with these beliefs in magic. I mean, seances were a common occurrence. It's not like this was so far away.
Mm-hmm.
I often say with this book, the craziest, most implausible stuff you will find in this book is either real, really happened, or it grows organically out of history.
So vested deep in the lore of the history that it's there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things that sound really outlandish are either born out from doing historical research into the period,
mm-hmm.
or learning about the Jewish mysticism and the different streams that come through there, through the folklore, or from my own family's history and things that happened to them, really.
Hmm.
So the more outlandish it is, the more likely it is in this book to be true.
True. Interesting. Very interesting. And particularly interesting, I was particularly of interest in the decisions Magda had to make regards to her own soul. And they changed. The end destination seemed to be the same. The end goal seemed to be the same each time. But the process changed,
mm-hmm.
by which she had to achieve it. Kind of what was behind the genesis behind that aspect of Magda's powers, kind of her ability to return to the living,
yes.
and bring back her own soul.
Well, another seed that inspired this book is the poem Lady Lazarus by Sylvia Plath. I mean, I read this poem when I was a freshman in college,
mm-hmm.
and it's written as this extended metaphor about her suicide attempts and her ability to come back from the dead. Metaphorically, and she had many issues with her dad, and her dad to her represented this kind of oppressive fascist presence
in her life,
at least in the way she expressed it in her poetry. I'm a very literal-minded soul, so I read this as a 17-year-old girl. I was like, this is cool. This Jewish girl would not stay dead. She refused to die. She would come back, and she slaughtered those Nazi bastards, and she did it again and again. She
Hitler can keep on coming.
Right. It's like she rises with her red hair, and she eats men like air.
Oh, wow.
Cool. It's like Kill Bill, right? It's cool. So I just, you know.
Now, I am male, and let's remind everyone that I'm should have removed my chair a little.
No, the way I read that poem was very literally. She was assailing her murderers. And that little seed stayed in my mind for many years. Mm-hmm. I thought, what would it be like for someone who is a victim of the Nazis to refuse to stay dead?
Yeah.
To say, I'm not just going to lie in the grave you've made for me. I'm going to come back and exact my revenge.
Hmm.
I was like, yes.
Yes.
It's the ultimate what if. I mean, fantasy is about what if. And to me, given my background, that is the ultimate what if. And what if this person who could summon herself back from death could get to those murderers before they killed everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was a seed that sort of lay dormant in my mind for many years.
And was that the part of the story, that what if, was that the piece that kept tugging at you and kept pulling at you?
It was one of those things. And in the end, honestly, it was the voice of Magda Lazarus herself.
Mm-hmm.
She just kept telling me her story in my ear, and I kept saying, well, how about if we set it on another planet? I tried to set this book on another planet. It's true. I tried to set it in New York City in our current time. I tried all different settings. She said, you know where I'm from. You know where this all happened. Come on.
Come on. Get real.
Yeah.
Put me in my right place.
Right. If I could go through it, you can write about it. And that's basically the message I got. And I just had to develop the courage to say, you know, maybe this isn't my story. Maybe I don't have the right to tell it. But this person will not rest until I give her voice a place to speak. So, you know, in the end, it's like I didn't... You always have a choice. I could have kept saying no to her, but she would not shut up till I wrote this book.
How wonderful, metaphorically, she would not die.
Yes, she refused to give up, you know, and she would not. The story would not die. Okay.
Amazing. Now, just for everyone's sake, the book is not completely dour.
No.
And matter of fact, there's a large theme that runs throughout the book, but even that we're going to touch on. But one of the things throughout the book, and I was actually reading, and I found myself chuckling at your characterization of Eva Braun.
Oh, her name, Eva Farkas, you mean?
No, the...
Eva Braun, Hitler's girlfriend.
Hitler's girlfriend.
Yes.
And your characterization of her.
Yes.
And what was that day of brainstorming like when you said, I'm going to make Hitler's girlfriend a dog?
Right. Well, right? Actually, and again, this is another example of stuff growing organically out of the facts. Hitler had a dog named Blondie,
mm-hmm.
and he loved that dog probably more than he loved David Braun. You know, so I thought, you know, the SS werewolves also come from the actual SS werewolf units that existed in the German army. They were supposed to be partisan units that would operate in the event of a German defeat. And I think that, you know, the defeat was so crushing that those werewolves decided not to activate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, a very literal-minded person as I will read about SS werewolves and be like, oh, that's just, well, okay.
Yeah, and I'll draw that connection.
Right.
Yeah.
I just sort of followed it and said, yeah, you know, these werewolves are Nazis. They're SS. And they're like, you know, they swore their fealty to the pack leader supreme, Adolf Hitler. And Adolf is actually a derivation of the word wolf.
Mm-hmm.
In German, and he identified very much with wolves.
With wolves, sure.
So to me, this is just organically how the concept of, you know, why are werewolves Nazis in this book? Well, because the roots of that are in the actual history.
Yeah, sure. Well, and the reference to Blondie, I just thought a docile, although in the book's not necessarily characterized but by being docile, but to see that characterization of Hitler, and then you even see, I think you make a reference where Magda's observing his behavior with the dog.
Yes.
You know, and saying, I'm not going to give in to seeing this, you know, this behavior. Sure, he might have a touching moment with this dog.
Right.
I'm not giving in
right.
to this behavior. Which, on the larger scale, this book is really, well, you've got all the elements of Magda returning. She's returning for something. Sometimes she doesn't admit it, but she's constantly returning for something.
Yeah.
And Raziel plays a huge role in that, and her sister, Giselle, plays a significant role in that. And really, this book's is really about love.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. So you want to mention or talk a little bit about the underpinnings of that element to the story.
Yeah, I mean, this is what propels Magda across the wall of fire. I mean, she comes through the fire. She won't even die because she loves her sister. And, you know, she becomes more than she thinks she could be because of her love for her sister.
Yeah.
And so that love calls forth the best in her. And she's willing to commit evil in service to that love.
Mm-hmm.
So it raises a lot of moral questions about, you know, the intersection of love and free will. And what sacrifices will you make for love? And will those sacrifices doom that love?
Which is an interesting question because depending on your belief system, love is all powerful. And we're talking about a higher love than a romantic love,
yes,
although that plays a part in it, with Giselle in particular.
Yes.
This is a higher love than just your normal run-of-the-course romantic love, so,
yes,
which I thought posed some interesting questions.
And, it, you know, it makes the dilemmas for her very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she is willing to throw herself in the fire, but she may be dooming her sister, she may be dooming this angel by doing those things. So she's really, I just really tortured her in this book. I mean, she really has a couple of impossible choices to make,
right,
and
sure,
she's sort of groping around in the dark, just trying to make the right choice. And in the end, that's all any of us can do. We have to choose, and we choose again, and we choose again. And if your touchstone is love, and you just keep moving in that direction, you have no way to know whether you're right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something to hold on to, it gives you a through line. And, you know, there's no answer to this question for her. There's no answer of, did you do right, did you do wrong? You know? And it's, love is the thing she can hold on to, whether she is right or wrong.
Wrong. The other part of that, too, is making that choice. And I don't want to give away the ending of the book, although I would have instructors argue that the ending's okay because it's the journey we should enjoy, right? But in this case, in this instance, in the end, you made a conscious choice to break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about kind of your inspiration and your decision,
sure,
to do that?
Sure. And it folds right back into that theme of love. One of the, you know, there's a lot of, as you can see from our conversation, there's a lot of inspirations for this book. But in terms of structure, one of the types of literature that really inspired me were the memoirs of people who survived the war. There's a whole literature out there of people like Anne Frank who lived,
mm-hmm,
people who wrote about their personal experiences and recreated either from a great distance or from right after the war, their experiences in the war, the people that they lost in the war, the reasons that they survived when the people around them died. And it was those memoirs are often written in that very confessional,
mm-hmm,
you know, the fourth wall's invisible. They're speaking directly from you.
To the reader,
right,
yeah.
From the writer to the reader, there is no wall. There is no, you know, stage. It's just naked. The person is expressing their deepest thoughts, their regrets, their hopes, the adventure, everything directly to the reader. And so in this way, it's like a magical memoir. And so I think of those, all these people are my heroes. I mean, these are people who were in the underground, who worked as spies, who were partisans, who were in the camps. All those people created a corpus of literature, and it's really like, you know, how to survive in a nightmare, you know, night, it's like a nightscape. How do you, you know, it's like almost like instructions for
surviving
hell.
Yeah, sure.
You know, how do you do that? And so in some ways, this book is really an homage to that body of literature and really like a tip of the hat to these incredible heroes who are true, who really did survive something as bad as what Magda describes in this magical book.
Well, nicely done, miss. Nicely
Thank
done.
Thank you. Thank
You're
you
welcome.
Very much.
You're welcome. One of the other interesting things as it relates to the book and doing a little research on you and looking at the marketing was that I noticed that you have an agent, Lucienne.
Yes.
Lucienne Diver,
yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Who is also in the author, is also an author in the same general marketing category. What's it like having an agent who's also an author?
It's great. And, you know, sometimes I tell people this and they're a little surprised. I think there's sort of a hesitancy on the part of some authors to have someone also writing as well as being an agent. There's this maybe a sort of clandestine sense that there's a conflict of interest built into that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, and I guess it depends on the individual agent. Maybe in some cases there is some kind of conflict of interest. But with Lucienne, she's just been 100% great. I mean, she's, and I think there's a lot of advantages to having an agent who writes because, one, she understands my twisted psyche from the inside out. Yeah. And so it's not simply pity that makes her, you know,
she understands moments of temporary insanity.
Right. She encourages them. She understands them. So it's good, you know, and she understands it on a visceral level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that helps in terms of coming up with workarounds, you know, coming up with deeper thematic meanings. I mean, you don't have to be a writer to be a great editor or to see in, but I think she understands the process in a way that it's difficult, even as an editor, to understand. And I, you know, also in terms of marketing and trying to reach an audience, she's just really good at that. She's very, very good at internet marketing, real life marketing, and really developing a meta message about you as an author. And she's just really been invaluable in helping me to come out of my writer cave and reach my audience and really grow as a writer. And, you know, a great agent can do that without being a writer themselves, but I think she just brings a level of insight into what marketing and promotion does take out of you as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she understands how to help you. And she's just so creative. I mean, really enjoyed working with her. And she's just been great.
Well, one of the things that I thought was a cool element to this was that I had noticed, I think either from your blog or hers, that you guys ended up having like a dual book release party in New York.
It was
and you were releasing both books, and you guys, just from the photos, I kind of scanned through the photos, it looked like you guys had the best time.
Oh my
God. You know, the best time.
It was great.
And she's got a supernatural element, I think, to her book too, so it all thematically kind of worked well.
Yes, it's wonderful because she writes young adult funny vampire fiction.
Okay.
So it's not quite the same niche. But what was so wonderful about that party, and I would have not thought to do it, was we were able to combine our audiences and really have a fantastic event where, you know, she was able to pull her people in, I was able to pull my people in, and we really combined it to create a supernatural soiree. And it was a really wonderful event, and I would never have thought to do it the way that we ended up doing it together. It was sort of, you know, there's a synergy there, and it ended up being greater than either one of us could have done on our own.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, just she was able to pull on so many avenues and venues that she has access to as an agent and contacts, and she was really able to, you know, help me create something that was very, very special. It was a great way to kick off the series.
Yeah, it looked like it was a lot of fun.
It was fabulous. It was great.
Now, how involved does she get in the, because she's a writer as well, you'd mentioned maybe some editing. She'd probably get involved even in story, helping with story creation and ideation. And
yeah, it's like having the best critique partner. She's just wonderful because, you know, instead of micro-editing and, you know, tweaking things and, you know, if you do that, sometimes you set a chain reaction in motion in a book where you suddenly are rewriting the entire thing.
Yeah.
She's very good at, her reaction to things, her instinctive reaction is yes, great. If she likes it, that's why I picked her as an agent, you know. Her first reaction is to say yes and let's try it. And how about this? She's got such a positive outlook. And I think part of that is that creative urge that leads to her writing. It's, you know, she's able to look at a work as a structural whole and say, you know, this part breaks down, this part really works for me, without picking it apart. You know, I know some people who have very involved agents who go back 3, 4, 5 times before it's ready. She gives you more of a bird's eye view. She's like just really like the best critique partner ever.
That's excellent to hear.
Yeah.
That's excellent to hear. Now, tell our listeners a little bit. I know this is your second book, the first in the series. So you've had a couple books published, but tell our listeners a little bit about how you got started as a writer.
I think it was one of those hardwired things. I think, you know, writers are both born and made, I would say,
so,
you know.
Sure, that's fair.
So I think that, you know, I have the hardware built into me. But, and I, of course, started reading. I was reading from a very young age, and I think a lot of writers enter the world of imagination through the reading.
Sure.
You know, so I'm always was a very intense reader, but I think it's that same lack of entitlement that I felt about this story. I felt about writing in general. I didn't feel I deserved to be a writer. To me, writers were these exalted mythical beings. You know, it's like these heroes, like Mount Rushmore, but with writers' faces up there. You know, like you know.
Wow, Mount Rushmore. I put like, mine on a pedestal, but
no,
I didn't carve
like,
them into.
You know, like oh my god, you know these great writers. So you know, the thought of little me being able to, you know, occupy the same field as, you know, my heroes, it just seemed like, you know, an impossible dream. So I didn't even let myself think that that was a possibility. And it's like, and all, the other thing that was slowing me down is just like intense perfectionism. And I think it's like a flip side of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just pick, 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 pick. And so I couldn't get out of the way of the stories that were crowding around in my head. I mean, I was always telling little stories to other people, writing them, but I wouldn't let myself finish things, you know? And it wasn't until once I had kids, that whole perfectionism thing just would not wash, you know? It just went away after that.
Because you know, kids are amazing at destroying the best laid plans. So,
yes,
yeah.
It's just sort of, you know, perfectionism wasn't even worth pretending to be something you can achieve. There's just no way you can mm-hmm. achieve perfection in this world when you're trying to juggle so many things. And so that was actually a great gift to me because I realized, you know, I have a friend who says, anything worth doing is worth doing half-assed. And that became my motto. Go ahead, embrace the suck, do it badly, and by doing it, you learn.
Yeah.
And just letting myself do it because I loved it. Again, love, it just, you know, wrong or right, if you follow it, that's where the adventure is. So that's what gave me the permission, that sense of, well, it's okay, so you stink, so
so what, yeah,
right, you love to do it, so go for it.
Yeah, go do it. And there's an expression I like to hear that it's like you can't do anything without showing up.
Right.
So if you show up, you're at least halfway there. I mean, you're halfway there.
Yeah. I mean, so much of writing is just getting out of your own way.
Yeah.
And just letting it happen. And so to do that, you really do have to show up. You have to, you know, come to page, be open, and let her rip, you know?
Well, we're glad you did. Lady Lazarus, I have to tell you, is beautifully written. Just beautifully written.
Thank you.
So if you didn't achieve perfection, we're close. So
thank you.
We're close.
It means a lot to me. Thank you.
It's beautifully, beautifully written. Where are you with the next book in the trilogy, Dark Victory?
Yes, Dark Victory. Dark Victory sort of picks up where Lady Lazarus leaves off. I just gave the revised manuscript to my editor. And we're waiting for a date.
Okay.
I'm hoping 2011, but I haven't gotten a specific date. It's not on the calendar yet.
Okay. But it's written.
Yes, it's there.
What about the third book?
The third book, I don't even have a title for. I have a title in my mind,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to, you know, jinx myself by putting it out publicly.
Okay.
It's there, and I know the broad outlines of where we're going to be. And, you know, it's a three-book cycle at this point, so I know.
And it all takes place within World War II. It draws to conclusion within the conflict.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's a huge canvas.
Yeah.
I mean, I could just keep painting and painting on it. It's
sure could.
A lot of fun. And it's a great adventure that I'm following Magda after. You know, she goes all over the place in Dark Victory. And it's cool. One of the fun things about writing Lady Lazarus were the cameos. I mean, a lot of the people who show up were actual figures from history, and that happens even more in Dark Victory.
And to see the moments in time. Yeah, I know there's a historical reference you make in a particular ploy that's used by Hitler at the end
mm-hmm.
that as someone who's interested in the conflict and the war itself, it was loved how you incorporated that into the
thank
book.
You.
So
yeah.
I'll be excited to see how historically you weave some of those references into the book,
yes.
too.
Yes, and what's exciting, too, is, you know, as Magda weaves her magic, I mean, you always have this sort of paradox when you're writing urban fantasy of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of an alternate world is this? And how much of the history ends up coming to pass? I mean, you know, how much is this prophecy altered just by having been made? Mm-hmm. So as I go along in the series, things get more and more screwed up. Like, it really does trash Eastern Europe in doing this. And, it, you know, it's exciting to see what she's able to save and what she's not. And, you know, you could just see the trajectory start to veer off, especially in the second book.
Is there ever an instance in the book that a decision that she makes actually results in it and has an effect on a part of the conflict?
Yes.
To a negative end?
Well, it's one of those things where it's a little complicated. Okay. You know, her unintended consequences quotient is off the scale.
That's what I was getting the vibe of. That's why I asked.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, the problem is everything, you know, happens in a balance. So if you remove one part of the balance, the other side goes haywire.
Okay.
So, you know, given all the different forces that are against each other at the beginning of World War II. If you affect one, I don't want to give away the story, but you know, if you affect one aspect, you know, one cohort of this battle, then other cohorts will be affected as well. So it is like a domino effect. It's a cascade where, you know, you alter one fact and, you know, everything starts to go haywire.
Yeah, pull the thread of the sweater. We'll look forward to getting the release date and look forward to book two for certain.
Great.
Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, the first stop should be my website, which is www.michellelang, that's michellelang.com. And I have a very untidy blog there. I have writing samples that people can see, news, appearances, things like that. And I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. So come on down, find me. I love making friends.
No, on Twitter and Facebook, just same name, just your name. One string.
Right.
Okay. Excellent. And you share some very historic, we've been following each other a little while on Twitter.
Yeah.
For those of you, and I'm going to break the fourth wall on that, for those of you listening to the podcast, she shares some amazing, you want to follow her because she shares some amazing historical references. I find myself looking at a website and then seeing you share some of those same historical references that you find online that same day. So it's really, it's cool. It's like we're mind melding.
That's excellent.
Cool. Anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners that I may have missed?
Just come on down to my website. I'm hoping to have some associated content. I want to get up free reads, deleted scenes. So as I go ahead in this adventure of this series, I'm going to be putting out more and more things for my readers.
Excellent.
And I really, you know, my readers have given me such wonderful feedback for this book. And just thank you for checking out Lady Lazarus. And I really enjoy getting feedback and letters. So please feel free to give me, you know, drop me a line.
Okay. Well, Michelle, I've truly enjoyed speaking with you today. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to tonight's main event, E-Book Deathmatch! Our contestants will be battling hard to determine who will win this pivotal bout. In this corner, we have Scott, Spiritual Tramp Roche. And in the other corner is Keith, Ed Gizmo Hughes. The contestants are ready, so let's get ready to rumble!
Hi, this is Keith Hughes. Ebook Deathmatch is a selling competition between me and Scott Roche that runs from June 6th through June 20th. But I don't want you to buy my ebook. I want you to buy his. Here's how this will work. I'm asking that everyone hearing this buy Scott's kick-ass horror anthology, Through a Glass Darkly, from the Amazon Kindle store or from Smashwords. Likewise, he will be trying to sell my ebook, Borrowed Time. After July 20th, the sales will be tallied and a winner declared. But there's more for you to do than just buy Scott's book. The loser in this contest will have to perform some sort of task or activity, and we want you to decide what that will be. So if you have something fun for Scott to do, when he loses, drop me a line with your idea by June 13th. Then we'll post a poll where you get to vote for your favorite. And don't forget to buy your copy of Through a Glass Darkly before June 20th. Visit penslinger.com for more information and links to buy the ebook. Do it for Scott. Do it for me. Do it for America. But most importantly, do it for the puppies.
please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at MusicAlley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.